Hello, welcome to Audible Autism, Interesting People and Interesting Facts. On this episode, me and Sarah will be interviewing Jason Hodgson, who tells us about his experiences as an experimental music composer, composing for Dungeons & Dragons orchestral arrangements, and just all sorts of fascinating work in regards to how being autistic goes hand in hand with his work in terms of composing and just generally being encouraging for other people out there. Enjoy. It's an interesting episode.
Testing, testing, testing. Can you hear me? This is Audible Autism.
Okay, so on the show today we have Jason, who is a composer and a student at the University of Canterbury, is it?
Canterbury Christchurch.
Yep. Canterbury Christchurch University. And he is here to tell us about his experiences with autism and life as a composer. So thank you very much for coming on, Jason.
Pleasure.
Would you like to cover composing or autism first?
Oh, they kind of fall hand in hand together with me. Might as well start with autism.
Yeah, yeah. Do you tell us more? Because you were diagnosed at the age of 9, weren't you?
Yeah, quite early. I'm aware how lucky I was to be diagnosed early. So I've never really known any different. However, I have noticed more of a challenge socially the higher up I go in education and the older I get. Which can be difficult considering that music is quite a social career.
Interesting. What differences have you noticed?
An example from my first year, I found it very difficult to build up an ensemble. I was very academic orientated, I still am, and I couldn't read the signals when people weren't interested in joining the ensemble, despite me thinking that I'm the most open person there because I have multiple genres I can perform in and I've got 5 different instruments I can play for them. But despite me trying to start it early, prior to the task being set at uni, it never quite clicked that no one else was interested. I found this quite challenging. But weirdly enough, what was challenging about it was not the social aspect, but the fact that I thought it was going to affect my grades, which is, again, not a neurotypical mindset, very much an autistic mindset.
Interesting. I mean, you said that you are currently working with a team of 25 now, so you must have worked around that somehow.
I've definitely learned some tactics, but I find when I've got a role to play in the team, whether that's a leader or somewhere else within that, I find I can work much better when I've got this set parameters that I can work around. So if this team of 25, we're a live Dungeons & Dragons concert.
Okay.
It's a strange concept, but we've managed to have a successful pilot series. We're now trying to apply for funding. Yay, paperwork. And despite me being the project manager, I became very aware that this was a very equal team. A lot of them were on the spectrum or had other mental health conditions or even had experience with people on the spectrum, being on the Dungeons & Dragons side of things, which made it much easier to have my moments of, I have no idea how to interact with you. But I said, I have a role and I can stick to that. When I go to something, say a conference, when I don't necessarily have a role set, I don't have a label, say if I'm not presenting, I will always assign myself a role and say, right, I'm here, I'm advertising me as a business, not me as a person. And it sounds like such a simple mindset to switch, but it's very helpful just changing that mind field and going, I am here representing business rather than myself. It takes all the stress away from how I'm interacting personally. I can't really tell how I do it. It's something I've learned. I mean, I've been around my grandmother most of my life, who is a saleswoman. She's been a saleswoman for multiple businesses. And I've just kind of been dragged along to networking meetings. Like, it's probably heavily influenced by that. So again, what is the most difficult is I can't always explain what my head is doing or why it's doing it. But I just know that if I do A, B, and C, D will work.
I think there's also something to be said for people, yeah, autistic people really enjoying talking about things that they love, and that, you know, if you're less keen on talking about yourself, then you're naturally going to be much better at talking about something that, you know, is important to you. And by sort of diverting the things that you need to do and putting them in the category of this is a work thing, as opposed to, you know, I need to know how to socialize with people, it does just change your perspective on things and make it easier, because you're sort of doing something with a purpose as opposed to just talking to someone.
Absolutely. And I'd say I'm, again, quite lucky that the field I'm in, I'm an experimental composer. So the field I'm in, I can be a bit eccentric and get away with it. But when I go to the more popular side of things, I find myself being that person in a corner, not quite sure how to talk to people, or whether I get worried about how I'm interacting with them. Am I too much? Am I talking about myself too much? Am I not enough? Wait, am I giving right eye contact? No, yes. I and then it just becomes quite overwhelming. So I try to avoid the scenarios where I feel like that, which is probably not very healthy. But I am lucky that most of my career and most of my personal life can be based around my interest. But I'm aware that I'm becoming quite a, I would say one track mind, but I do have multiple tracks, but they're all within the realm of geeks or music. And that's it. There is nothing else about me, I find.
It makes sense, but it's also, I find it's very interesting in that, compared to the experience I've had in certain fields I have, I find I sense sort of, I don't know how, but not because I don't have the sales, sort of sales thought like yourself, but in my thinking, in the places that I've been, it's like I am going in to do something specific, and I might, you know, I'm not saying that I won't interact with people, but I'm here to do a specific task. And I just wonder if it's not because I haven't set it clear, but then I'm not sure if that, I generally don't think that's something that needs really explaining. I think people understand. They feel it's sort of almost a bit off-putting at times when you're just, you know, because for me, I tend to kind of stick to myself a lot of the time, but people sort of find that a bit off-putting because you're not, I don't know, you're not putting yourself out there and you're not trying to have a banter about with people or whatever. But I don't know, it just brought back some interesting memories of mine hearing you say that.
Well, one thing I should say is a lot of my separate categories that make me autistic, I'm very atypical in them, where on the more stereotypical side, so I am a highly sociable person, outgoing.
Mm-hmm.
However, what makes that difficult is I do talk about Doctor Who, Dungeons and Dragons, music, dice. I've got very limited interest in myself.
Right.
And I do find it difficult to interact and engage in conversations about other people. And I'm aware how rude that can seem. And it's still a challenge. More so the older I get, because it's almost like I don't have the little kid excuse anymore. But I do find when I go into the conference setting or the conventions, or I'm presenting a piece of music in an ensemble, because it's got a very specific task, I can talk about this thing and I can talk about this interest I have. And it seems makes me look more knowledgeable than I probably really am on that topic. So I've kind of tried to learn how to use it to my advantage where it can be used in that way. But I'm aware that from the outsider's point of view, it can seem like I'm purely career driven, purely interested in anything that's in my own interest and not others.
Right.
When
right.
that's the opposite, I just find it extremely difficult to engage on that level.
Mm-hmm. I think that is something that you can broaden out to purely social events eventually, though. I know that when I went to university, I had a very restricted time in secondary school. We got broadband at the age of 13, and I went into my bedroom and just didn't come out again until I was 18 and left home. And so it very much left me wondering, you know, how on earth do you sort of make friends and that sort of thing if you're walking into a completely different situation. And the way I found to do it was to go and join a student society, sit on the committee of that society, and then organise socials in the pub, where I then, you know, had to go and everyone else sort of socialised around me because it was an event we'd organised. And I, you know, sat in the corner in my role as organiser and sort of watched it all happen, and then eventually sort of picked it up from there.
You did the exact same thing I did. In my first year, I didn't join any societies and regretted it. Then realised there wasn't a Doctor Who society and decided to set one up. And from there, I've certainly feel I've grown socially. People now come and talk to me about the societies, and they recognise me. I feel I can be more engaged with them. But again, it's the giving yourself a role that really helps, which again can seem
it can seem
quite forceful, like you're forcing yourself on people because you have that role. They have to speak to you in a certain way and with a certain topic. I don't know if that really is the case, or whether that's my little bit of paranoia in my head. Sometimes it definitely feels like that. However, with that, I've managed to join other societies. I don't actually run a society anymore. I'm a member of the Dungeons and Dragons Society. And that itself has helped me learn how to socialise. We're thrown in the situation in our game where you don't know what's going to happen. You're not in control of it. And it's heavily role-playing. So you get to explore different facets of your personality. I did start with quite a thoughtful character that didn't like to hurt people, always defense, not offense. And it eventually grew into this character that won't necessarily go and fight everyone else, but will not take rubbish from his own party. If they're doing something wrong, he will say so. And actually, I found that role-playing in those situations has allowed me to look at how I am in everyday scenarios. I've managed to get my husband into Dungeons and Dragons, and he's also on the spectrum, but he's a high level of social anxiety. He had one session of Dungeons and Dragons, he enjoyed it, and he's already come out of his shell. But again, it comes back to the you have a role, you have a focus, and I think that's neurotypicals need to be aware that that's a useful tool to those that are neurodiverse, and not to push us out of that, because we will get there eventually.
Yeah,
it's quite interesting, because I only really played Dungeons & Dragons for the first time this year, and prior to that, I'd always previously thought of it as very much you roll a dice. I don't know, I think I kind of imagined it as Snakes and Ladders, sort of very mechanical. And then I started to play it and discovered that actually I had to pick a bunch of traits and then play, you know, someone else, and what would we do in that scenario, and interact with my team. And I was really quite taken aback by how social it is, given how many autistic people are involved in it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I made probably the closest friends in my my third year, my first year of masters and second year, actually. I made my closest friends playing games like that, and I actually go out to the pub and drink with them. I don't drink alcohol, I'm teetotal, and one of my other diagnoses is PTSD, and some of that's related to alcohol. So I'll just avoid it, because on top of the social interaction, there was also the alcohol, and that freaked me out. So I just not go out to the pub, not just go, no, you guys go, I'll go home, which also stopped me making friends.
Sure.
But actually, I go out after a game on a Sunday. We go to the pub. I have my J2O, which I'm unless we find a good pub with nice mocktails. And I talk to them outside of D&D. I engage with their other, with their interests. It's all about familiarity of and the role, and it just, and bringing back to the career aspect, being in the music industry is highly sociable, and it's as much as what you know as who you know and how you present yourself.
Sure.
Even more so in the in other performing arts like drama.
Hmm.
So in a sense, I'm kind of forced into, I love it so much that I'm not going to give it up. I'm forced into these social situations. So using my obsessiveness to an advantage is a tool I've had to learn, and I still haven't mastered it, over 5 years.
Hmm. So you said that you were an experimental composer rather than a mainstream one. So why don't you tell us sort of what that is, and then take us into explaining this Dungeons & Dragons live music event that you organise?
So experimental composition is really what it says on the tin. It's experimental. It's all about trying new tools or old tools in a new way. It's not about following the mainstream for the sake of following the mainstream. There's a lot of pop music out there, or even film music that is experimental in itself, such as, Jaws was quite experimental. Mm-hmm. Psycho, very experimental, very dissonant. And most of the horror genres and sci-fi genres and fantasy, they tend to glorify experimental music.
I would also add, just as a recent one, I saw the Paul Schrader film First Reform not too long ago, and that was the soundtrack was done by Lost Maud, who is well known in the field of making dark ambient music. So that's another really good example of how there's a lot of, they tend to reach for more experimental composers in film music.
Yeah, and in the pop side, I mean, Bjork isn't as popular in the UK as she has been in the past, but, and people have a love-hate Marmite relationship with her and her music, but she became very popular with experimental stuff.
True.
Hmm.
So it's there everywhere, but it's not always labeled experimental music. And what it means to me is I get to play with things like dice and numbers and statistics to create music, or Dungeons and Dragons, things outside of the, in quotation marks, the soul that people normally assign music creation to. It's kind of a barrier with some of my old peers when I was studying a bachelor's level. So I've had pieces where I've rolled the dice to control the performers, given them their notes, their starting and ending places live on stage. And it creates this atmosphere to allow the music to give meaning on its own, and for the audience and the performers to provide their own meaning. One thing I found frustrating was I was always told that major equals happy, minor equals sad, dissonance is grungy and dark and should be avoided in harmony as much as possible. I was like, no, I like dissonance. Dissonance makes me happy. I prefer minor. I actually sing in a more Arabian minor mix mode. My age is a bit boring. I don't find major happy at all. I find it a bit dark. I find there's something behind that cheeriness. So I was always told how to feel about the music and its tools. And as soon as I entered the experimental world, I went, brilliant. I don't have to give my meaning. I give my context, but not necessarily what I mean and my emotions. I don't have to express that.
Sure.
That was one thing that was stopping me from composing, was the fact that I was told that it had to be emotional or express an emotion of something or someone else or something deeper.
Why is it that you think that majors are considered happy? Like, what is that doing to people that they think that?
There's this long theory that's to do with the waveforms and how they interact with us and the ears. There is some truth to them. I mean, it's obviously true because the majority of people for a long time have thought in certain sounds are dissonant and certain sounds are consonant. But it changes with time. I mean, if I played a jazz chord to, I would say Mozart, but Mozart was quite experimental. He actually used dice in some of his music. If I played a jazz chord to any one of the more classical composers from the 17th century, say, they they would look at me in horror and disgust. And yet that jazz chord is quite harmonic and considered quite normal today. So it's kind of, I think it's a mixture of scientific truth that we've yet to truly figure out, though I'm sure there's some music psychologist out there who's going to listen to this and go, actually, Jason, we have some more hard evidence. Fantastic. Send it over here so I can read it. I do have to fill out 60,000 words for my PhD. But I do think there's some societal thing where because we're told it's happy, therefore we think it's happy. And it's almost like the autistic brain gives me an excuse to go, well, no, I think differently.
Interesting. I wonder how many other autistic people feel that way. Okay, I mean, you say that you compose music and then it's performed. So what kind of instruments are we talking about?
Oh, all sorts. My favourite type of instrument to compose is called open. So you create a score that can be interpreted by any instruments, sometimes any number of instruments. But I tend to put a range on it because 50 people interpreting from the same score can be a bit of a cacophony. So I wrote this score it was for an ensemble that already had a piano, a cello, and there was flute and violin. And it was a concerto, so that's an ensemble and a soloist. But I didn't specify the instruments, but the instructions were the soloist were to follow a random instruction generator, giving them a note and how to play that note. Sorry, I'm going to say pitch because I'm aware that other musicians may be listening and pitch and note are two very different things. So I gave them a pitch, A for example, and how to play it, vibrato. I then gave the soloist the instruction to go up in a varied direction on their instrument in their pitch range and they'd end on the highest note they could play. The ensemble then had to follow the soloist by playing the note, sorry, the pitch that they thought the soloist was playing. They're going to get it wrong, and that's where the music comes from, in the wrongness. The mistakes are what make that piece of music. But on the other hand, I've composed a one-man percussion opera, recommended probably a PG rating, which was taken from a Dungeons & Dragons campaign, but it was one man, his percussion instruments, telling a story, him playing about five different people. So it really varies. I suppose the only, quote, autistic piece I've composed, so I don't tend to compose pieces about my autism or my experience of the world, but this piece on reflection seems to hold in a certain perspective, is a piece called It Takes All Sorts. Mm. The idea wasn't to represent any of the autistic traits, but it involves performers being blindfolded, given a random number of sweets, and reacting to the taste, the texture, or the memory that are conjured by the sweet. On reflection, I realised that what I was doing was giving neurotypical performers an experience of what it's like to have some form of hypersensitivity to taste or textures, and maybe even smell if they're really strong-smelling sweet. And I gave them permission to make noises, which is a very common reaction for someone on the spectrum, is to make a noise. It's not the only reaction, but it's certainly one of the more commonly presented traits.
How did they tell you that felt afterwards?
They didn't know it was to do with autism. I didn't know it was to do with autism until they expressed how, as soon as you remove one sense, the smooth jelly bean suddenly became very rough in their mouth. they could a taste that they would normally just eat, they found very strong and empowering, and some had to spit it out. And when I told them it was coconut, they went, "Oh, that's odd. I like coconut." So it was nice to hear them express that. And I go, yeah, that's kind of what I get when I eat mushrooms or smell the smell of rising bread. It does make my head spin as well, but it's just too powerful. I love the smell of rising bread, but I can't be in the same room as it.
Sure.
So that piece kind of became a reflection on hypersensitivity, but really the idea was, what happens if I blindfold performers and give them something to react to?
That's very interesting. Did you have an audience for that?
Yes, we have multiple. It's one of the most commonly asked for pieces. I've performed it with the Scratch Orchestra, the Canterbury Scratch Orchestra, which is unfortunately no longer an ensemble. They broke up a couple of years ago now due to underfunding, and they performed it a couple of times in the concerts at the university. I've presented it at a Royal Music Association / British Federation of Ethnomusicology conference in Huddersfield this year, and it's interesting to see the audience react, because it's just a bunch of noises, yet my grandmother, who can't stand most of my experimental music, was sitting there listening to it and realised, actually, I can hear something here. I can hear some rhythm. I can hear some melody.
That is, it's all of your pieces, I must say, so far sound really interesting, especially the one-man percussion piece, which, if I may interject with sort of like a little bit of my own like sort of experimental music knowledge, that sounds very much like a Edgar Varese kind of idea.
Yeah, I've actually based it off a Peter McGarr percussion opera.
Okay.
The guy performing it in the workshop video I have online, unfortunately I had a live performance of it, but because it was written for my third year of my bachelor's. He performed a opera, The Vanishing of Bleaklow, by Peter McGarr, performed at the Coma Summer School in 2015, and I just kind of fell in love with this opera. I'm not a big fan of opera. There's only a couple of operas I like, and they're not the mainstream ones.
Okay.
Chris Brannick, he performed this piece that was absolutely bonkers, but told a story with sound effects, and there was some music, some more traditional music in it, but most of it was sounds that represented something a bit more abstract.
Okay.
I'll run away with that idea, and couldn't figure out a story, so I went to sit and watch a Dungeons & Dragons campaign, realised I'd had too much, and tried to get like 4 months of Dungeons & Dragons story into about 15 minutes of a performance, which had about seven people at the table with one person playing all those characters, plus non-player characters.
Wow. And forgive me, what is a percussion opera?
So a percussion opera is basically an opera, which is a story told with purely music. This, unlike a musical where there's speaking as well. Although it does stretch in the experimental world, speaking can become part of the music. So it's a bit wobbly the more experimental you get. It's that exact definition. And all it means is it's an opera with percussion. There are no violins, there are no trumpets, clarinets, no other instruments besides the vocalist and percussion. Mm-hmm. And it just happens that they're the same person and he's running around ragged.
That sounds very interesting. You mentioned that you were inspired by that by your watching a Dungeons & Dragons campaign. So tell us how you ended up doing your Dungeons & Dragons live music event.
That was based off this piece I composed, which I'm just going to name drop here. It's called A Mummer's Farce. I would be doing my job if I didn't name drop it.
Of course, go for it.
I was thinking I'm doing this based off a past event, and I was wondering how that would work live. I've already experienced storytelling plus music. I'd been part of a workshop for a friend's master's project, actually part of the Scratch Orchestra, where she had fairy tales, very basic stock characters, the hero, the heroine, the villain, and then the sidekick. And that live story writers would start writing a story, but they would pick a character and the first person to react musically became that character for the rest of the story. And as you're writing, as they were writing the story, you as a musician were reacting to the story and telling the story live based on what you thought might be happening in the next word. And that kind of went, well, I can do this. Dungeons & Dragons has that element already. It's already got improvisation. It's already got elements of chance. You don't quite know what you're doing, but you've got some stock things you can work on. So most people would know how their characters would react in particular situations, or certainly wouldn't take much thought. But let's put that... Well, there's already music with Dungeons & Dragons, but it's normally recorded afterwards. Critical hits and put on music afterwards. And then later, during my workshopping of this project, Bombarded, who have become one of our supporters, they have live musicians playing, but they are the musicians playing Dungeons & Dragons. So they're bards.
Wow.
And they do some editing afterwards to tidy it up. I thought, well, that'd be lovely, but let's put in a live element. Let's have live musicians with live players and see what happens. And it started as this little taste that I was going to do a whole weekend of at my university, just because I happened to have rooms. And it grew bigger and bigger and bigger. And we had a pilot series at the Westgate Hall in Canterbury, which, whilst there were certainly elements I could improve on from an administrating point of view, in terms of the idea and the reactions we had to it, it's certainly got something we can move on with. So we're now working for funding. And I'm grateful to have an absolutely fantastic team. They're really enthusiastic. They're also on the spectrum, so they understand when we have our moments. So I had a stressed day the other day, really stressful day, and I forgot to meet up with my video guy to pick up the recordings, which is, from an administrative point of view, really bad, but from an autistic brain point of view, was just unavoidable.
Of course.
Mm.
And working with those kind of people, they go, no, it's all right, we understand, we'll just arrange to meet up. It's okay, it happens, it's fine. And actually, we raised money for the National Autistic Society for our pilot series as well. And it just happened to be the one voted in. So whilst this stuff isn't about autism, it very quickly becomes about how we can use people who have autism and how they can utilize their special interests and their special tools and techniques they implement in their everyday life, and how they can come together and put on a project, which I do feel a lot of businesses are missing out on. I think if they know, they tap into this obsessive side of autistics and the determination that we have to get something done, they can have their projects enhanced by us. I wouldn't say made better, because that's kind of almost anti-neurotypical. But if we utilize everyone's abilities, whether autistic or not, and work towards them rather than making them work to fit in our little box, you could achieve so much. I did not expect to have a concert at a hall for this project when it did in April. I just wanted a two-day test of the idea. And now we're applying for funding for a second series. It's not something I was planning for until after I tested the idea.
Mm.
And I bet with the success that you've had from this, you must be quite ecstatic, right?
Absolutely. There was a wobble at one point of me thinking that this is too big. How are we going to do this? Because it grew big very fast, but it kept me on my toes. And I, because of the team, could work around my condition, they took on parts of the project that would normally stress me out at that point, which was very, very useful. And we've managed to get tech and video. We've managed to get so many supporters like Bombarded, Level Up, local game shops like Dice and Destiny. And they, just by allowing us to work to our strengths, helped this project along, because there was no way on my own I would get in. I think July 2017, was the start of the project and the idea, and I popped it out on Facebook and going, what do you guys think? And in April 2018 was our first concert with zero budget.
Wow. Well done.
I'm more ecstatic about the team than I am about me, because actually I don't feel like I've done much of the work. It wouldn't have happened without them.
Hmm. Yeah, and I think one of the things that you said in your questionnaire was that the biggest problem that autistic people face at the moment is acceptance into adulthood. And I think you very much demonstrated, you know, what can happen if we realise that autistic children become autistic adults and work with that.
Yes, very much. The strangest thing I got on my first few weeks at the university was I have a learning support assistant. They're mainly there for translation between me and the tutor if I'm getting a fuddle with my words. They're also there to help with my note-taking and focusing on my studying when it comes to reading the written word. But some of the tutors, lovely as they are, they didn't quite get why I needed that support, particularly the LSP sitting into my personal tutoring sessions. So you're 18 now. You should be able to do this by yourself. I said, but I can't. And it's not like I haven't tried. I get in a fuddle, I get stressed out, and it's not helpful. I need someone there to kind of say, okay, you're going off on a tangent. What they said was, this is what I interpreted it as. You're misinterpreting it. And that goes both ways between tutor and myself, but they could not get it for the first few weeks. It just felt odd. It's like, you're 18 now, you shouldn't need that kind of help. You shouldn't need that kind of support. And that was very disconcerting. The fact that at a university, they were still saying that despite the university providing me with this learning support assistant.
Mm. That's incredibly annoying, isn't it?
It's an issue that I'm sure all of us have probably run into in one stage or another.
It did get better after a while, but it's still a challenge faced. One of my favourite personal tutors, I had to kind of teach him how to tell me to shut up, and because I go off on tangents when I'm stressed, when I'm getting a bit annoyed with myself because I can't explain what my process was in this composition or whatever. I go off on this huge tangent. And it took him a while to realise he is allowed to tell me to directly shut up and listen to what I'm saying. We'll deal with that in a minute. He said, I can't say that. It's rude. I went, but it's not. To me, I need you to tell me to shut up. But you should know when to. No. I need you to tell me when to shut up so we can move on. I cannot do that myself. It's going to take a while. I'm still learning that skill. I'm better than I was when I was 9. But I'm certainly not at the neurotypical level.
Yeah, I know a lot of autistic people now, and I've definitely found that, you know, when we're talking to each other, it's just so much easier for people to just be like, stop talking now, I'm talking. Yeah. And then the person who's been talking goes, I need to stop talking now. So this other person could talk. So much more straightforward.
And there's no offence taken. It's like, oh, okay, fair enough. Your turn.
Yeah, exactly. You said that your grandmother was diagnosed along with you, I think.
She was diagnosed, it was certainly not the same time as me, but it was certainly very close to it. She's actually going through the official paperwork now, because part of the list of how to get diagnosed, you need parents or people that knew you when you were younger. Well, most people, her parents have passed away. And she has no contact with people who used to know her when she was little. That's a bit irritating for those older autistics getting diagnosed so late in life. But certainly when we've had our clashes, it's between myself and my grandmother, we're aware that their clashes aren't personal. We're aware that those, clashes aren't personal. I mean, the majority, most families have their clashes, but when most autistic families have more clashes. And certainly when I was younger, when I couldn't understand what was going on or I couldn't express, I used to black out and throw a tantrum. But it wasn't the normal child tantrum. And I think had she not been diagnosed, who also has had her, my auntie's and my mother not being diagnosed as well, she wouldn't have taken it as this is a person or child who needs help and needs support. She probably would have taken it as this is a child that needs a slap. This is a child that needs more discipline. This is a bad child. In fact, the worst thing she could do was stop me from going to school rather than force me to go to school.
Of course.
So are you saying your entire family has been diagnosed with autism?
Not quite. It's on my maternal side, and my dad is also on the spectrum. So my dad, my mum, my grandmother, I can't remember whether one of my aunties is autistic, but certainly has dyslexia and dyspraxia and ADHD. My cousin, who passed away recently, he had autism and had ADHD. My brother has autism, and then I married a husband who also has autism, which just because we seem to attract each other.
Yeah, I was going to say several generations of Aspies finding each other and having autistic children. So.
And we certainly suspect my great nana, that's my grandmother's, my maternal grandmother's mother. Yeah. We certainly suspect she was on the spectrum somewhere. And from vague recollections, there was another family member that was put into an asylum or something. But I can't remember who that relative is. My great-grandmother upwards, we didn't really speak about the family, but I just remember a little snippet of that and going, well, that's probably because she was autistic,
sure.
But there wasn't that criteria. So we are family of autistics, and my poor grandmother's wife, who is a neurotypical, volunteered to come into a house full of us. and I'm sure the viewers can relate. When you have certainly what I call Aspie or autistic days, where just something isn't quite processing or processing too much, it's bad enough when it's just one of you. Imagine having four of us in the house and they line up, and then there's this poor, poor woman who's not on the spectrum, certainly at the beginning, who just can't quite understand what's going on. She has to go off to leave us to it, comes back, and we're sitting watching a movie, drinking a coffee.
Fantastic. Is there anything else that you wanted to let us know in terms of how people can find you, or sort of any message you want to get, any upcoming events or anything like that?
Well, you can certainly always follow me on Twitter. My tag is Jason, that's JASONH Composer. It's the same for Facebook. And my website is www.jasonhodgson, that's HODGSON, composer.co.uk. On there, I talk about how I've utilised my various parts of my conditions into my music, not necessarily in the music end, but certainly the tools that I use. I'm quite vocal about it, which sometimes can rub fellow composers up the wrong way. All I can say to anyone listening who is interested in being in the arts is don't be scared or worried that because you're not as socially intelligent, air quotes in that big term, it doesn't mean you can't interact with the arts. The arts is more than the mainstream. There is a lot more you can do and a lot more ways you can express yourself. You just need to look into it, and feel free to message me and email me, because there's no books out there, let alone books to how to become a composer. There are no books on how to get into the experimental world plus having autism in it. There is a group of us, there's no name for it yet, but there's a small group of us who are starting a community of autistic composers, and so you'll see that on my Twitter and my website when we've got that all sorted and finalized. That is being headed up by a guy called Ben Lunn. That's Ben LUNN, and he's written a blog about being autistic and being a composer. So we are out there, and I think because of the internet, we can use it to vocalize ourselves a bit better than in the past. We don't really have to interact with other people. We can just put it out there. So don't be scared. There are plenty of inclusive theatre groups and communities out there on the internet. Just go for it. Don't be worried that your idea of music or drama or film doesn't relate to another person. You'll find the higher up you get in your career, the deeper you get into your interest, eventually you'll be the only one that really knows your subject. And that's how that works anyway in academia. So don't be worried. Don't be scared. Just go for it. And to quote a company, which we're not going to say the name, I'm sure if I say the phrase, everyone will know it, and a particular sort of celebrity, just do it.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Jason, for coming on.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to drop in because I can. I'm very happy, quite pleased to be now part of the Autistic Empire team and on the Audible Autism podcast side. And it's going to be weird editing this podcast with me. I don't like listening to myself as it is. So hopefully I do it justice for you guys. I'll on the other end, and hopefully it all makes sense and I haven't cut out too much babble.
Okay, thanks very much, Jason. Odai, any last words or comments?
No, really, other than thank you.